Give your thumbs in Galatians chapter 3. We're going to come back to that passage very shortly. I have a couple of comments I'd like to make very quickly before we dive into the lesson this evening. I thought I would just make mention very briefly for those that may not be aware. I think everyone's aware that two of my brothers were moving to Montana to begin to work in Bozeman. And I'm not sure if everyone's aware that they began meeting last Sunday. This was their second week meeting there. And if you're not aware of the things that are going on in Bozeman and are interested, we do continue to support my brother Chris in the work that he's doing there. And we receive reports from him. And so you can check the hallway back here on the bulletin board or on the website. We post the reports there in the members area. And if there are some other avenues of information that if you're interested in, I can share with you. If you are interested in those, you can ask me about those later. But I thought folks would at least be interested in knowing that that work is underway and that we might continue to remember those men as they're working to begin that work. The other thing that I wanted to make mention of very quickly, I mentioned in the prayer at the singing on Friday night, a little boy named Grayson Judy. Some of you may know or remember Crystal Capehart. She's married now. Her name is Reed, Crystal Reed. Her sister, Rebecca, is married to Logan Judy. They just had their first child, a little boy, Grayson. He was born on Wednesday. Grayson had some issues related to a knot in his umbilical cord, and so he's had some oxygen deprivation. He's been in the NICU in a hospital in Indianapolis since Wednesday. They had him on some special therapy, trying to help his brain to heal as much as it could. And they took him off of that today, and the parents have finally been able to hold him. He's doing, as far as we can tell from the information we're getting, he's doing pretty well. But I'm sure they would enjoy you praying for their son and for their family. I said they're first-time parents, and so it's a difficult time being parents for the second time of a child that was in the NICU for 7 weeks. I can't imagine, even knowing that, what it might be like for that to be your first child and to be in that type of situation. Of course, Adam and Shelley Dieselkamp are in a somewhat similar situation with their child being in the NICU in Nashville, likely to be there for some time. So I'm sure all of those would appreciate prayers that you would offer on their behalf. I would like to thank the elders for the opportunity they've given me to speak this evening. As far as I can tell, I've not had such an opportunity to speak here at Eastside in a sermon for close to 3 years, most of that my own doing because of the things with the two little children and trying to keep up with all of Will's needs. I just have not felt like I was in a position to be able to do that. And when Gary let me know he was going to be gone and asked if I would be able to speak, I thought I should take advantage of that opportunity. And so I'm thankful for that opportunity to stand before you and to speak some this evening. I had several ideas of things that I wanted to talk about, and I kept passing over some things and coming to some things, and I made a decision about what I was going to speak about, and then I read an article this morning and almost changed my mind. But I'm going to say this, I mean this as an extreme compliment to our young people. The article really kind of irked me, and then as I got to thinking about the arguments that it made, I thought most of our young people could make the argument against the things that were being taught in that article. And so instead of spending a bunch of time trying to write a new sermon, I thought I'd just do the sermon that I already had prepared. So we are going to begin this evening in Galatians chapter 3. I want to thank Joel for the reading this evening. It was kind of lengthy, and I want to thank him for being willing to do that. If you haven't figured out by that reading, I'm going to talk for a little while this evening about the idea of adoption. And I talked a little bit about this in an invitation a couple of years ago on a Wednesday evening, and I'm not going to share exactly the same thoughts this evening. They're going to go a little bit more in depth, but I'm going to try not to spend a lot of time this evening. I told Nick I'm going to try to keep the sermon something under 2 hours. I was telling him I knew a preacher one time who was talking in a lectureship about how he had just bought a farm something under 500 acres, and people finally asked him exactly how big was your farm, and it was something like a half an acre lot that he built to build a house on. So my sermon will be something under 2 hours tonight. We'll see how much. So Galatians chapter 3 and chapter 4, Paul talks there about the idea of adoption. And There are several passages in the New Testament that mention adoption in some form, and as far as I can tell, I'm going to at least touch on all the ones that I could find this evening, because there are some points that I would like to make about those in conveying some things about adoption in, physical adoption in the world today, something that I do have some experience with along with my wife. We have some experience with that. If you aren't aware, both of our children are adopted, and so we've been through that process a couple of times, and I know others here have been through that process and have some familiarity with that. We know others. I'm sure all of us know others outside of the Eastside family that have adopted as well, and so something that we all have some kind of idea about, and so I thought I would talk about some things in conjunction with that this evening. Paul talks in this passage in Galatians, especially in chapter 4, in verse 5, he says, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of His Son into your hearts, crying out, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir of God through Christ. The Scriptures talk about our relationship with God in a number of different terms. And each of the ways that it describes that relationship has some particular meaning in the reason that it's described that way. The New Testament talks about our relationship with God as Him being the King and we are the citizens of the kingdom. It talks about Him being the Master and we are His slaves. And there are a number of other examples that we could give, the ways that the New Testament describes our relationship with God. The relationship we're going to talk about this evening is the one of father and child, and the New Testament talks about that in a couple of different terms, and we're specifically tonight going to look at the idea of the New Testament talking about our relationship with God as being adopted sons of God. And so what I intend to do this evening is look at three aspects of adoption in reality of the world today, and then describe how those ideas apply to our relationship with God as adopted sons. And the first thing that I wanted to talk about this evening is just the idea that adoption is expensive. It costs a lot of money to adopt in our society today. Sadly, I saw a meme on Facebook the other day that said something to the effect of, it's cheaper to kill a child in this country than it is to adopt a child. And it's sad, but it is true. It's relatively inexpensive to abort a child in this country, but it's very expensive in most cases to adopt. The Child Welfare Information Gateway Fact Sheet for Families, which is found on the childwelfare.gov website, so these are official government statistics, that website says that the cost of adopting in the United States can exceed $40,000 to adopt one child. It says cost of adopting may be minimal or can total more than $40,000 depending on a number of factors. Other statistics that the site gives is that expenses for a domestic adoption where the foster care system is not involved typically cost between $8,000 and $40,000. If you adopt through the foster care system. When you adopt through the foster care system, most of the time, a lot of the costs are absorbed by the state. And so you don't see a lot of out-of-pocket expenses for those types of adoptions. They almost always involve older children as well. And so that kind of throws the numbers for those particular types of adoptions off a little bit. But in general, most adoptions are usually cost between $12,000 and $40,000. In our case, both of our adoptions were north of $10,000. We had a lot of help in paying those fees, help that we're incredibly grateful for. But, I mean, the costs are just outrageous in what it can cost to adopt a child in this country. Expenses for international adoptions typically fall between $15,000 and $30,000. I'm not sure why the high end is lower for international adoption than it is for domestic adoption, but those are the numbers as they were given. And some of those, I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of these things, but some of those costs involved in include having a home study where you have a social worker that comes in and basically determines whether you would make a fit parent or not, and Depending on the social worker that you have to work with, that can be a pleasant or very unpleasant experience. We were lucky. We found a social worker that shared a lot of our convictions, and so she it was a pretty pleasant experience with her. But we've talked to others who've had really bad experiences because their social worker made all kinds of ridiculous demands, and there's not a lot of regulation in that, so the social workers can kind of do almost anything they want to and making you prove that you're going to be a fit parent. So there can be some cost involved in having those types of things done. You have to submit to all kinds of background checks. So we had to submit to a federal criminal background check, a state criminal background check, and a state child abuse check. And with the exception of the last one, there are some minor costs involved in those. There's just the travel costs. You know, both of our children were born in Florida, and so we had to travel to Florida, and the expense of staying there. We were, again, lucky that we knew people in the area that we could stay with that, you know, saved us some money, but that's not always the case. If you do international adoption, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but for a while, if you went to China to adopt, you had to go to the country and be there for like 2 weeks and then leave the country for some period of time and then go back again. And so you had all of the costs involved in all of that travel. And so there's just all kinds of costs that are involved when you're looking to adopt. When we look at the spiritual cost of adoption, and all I'm looking at in this point tonight is what it costs God. Think about what our adoption costs our God. Romans chapter 5, if you'll turn over to Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 6. Helps if I'm in Romans 5. Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 6. Paul writes, "Therefore, when we were yet without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps a good man, for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having now been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from wrath through Him. For if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of His Son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by His life. Not only that, but we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received the reconciliation." Our adoption cost the blood of Jesus Christ. God's Son had to die to pay for our adoption. Kind of makes $30,000 or $40,000 pale in comparison, doesn't it? That God was willing to give His Son so that He could adopt us into His family. Hebrews chapter 9. I'm going to have a rather lengthy reading here, so please turn over and follow along with me if you want. Hebrews chapter 9, beginning in verse 16. Hebrews is one of my favorite books. There's a lot of logical arguments that the Hebrews writer makes that I particularly enjoy following and making those connections the way the writer makes those connections. And that's true for the passage we're going to read tonight. Hebrews chapter 9, beginning in verse 16. "For where there is a testament, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. Therefore, not even the first covenant was dedicated without blood. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, 'This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you.' Then likewise he sprinkled the blood both of the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. And according to the law, almost all things are purified with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no remission. Therefore it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these." So the writer there is saying the articles that were used in the Old Testament worship had to be purified with blood of goats and calves and the blood of the sacrifices of the Old Testament. But he says those were the copies of the things that are in heaven. The things in heaven had to be purified with a greater blood, with a better sacrifice. Beginning again in verse 24, "For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood of another. He then would have to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment. So Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time apart from sin for salvation. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with these same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year make those who approach perfect. Again, you know, the writer there is talking about the idea that the sacrifice of the Old Testament could not completely remove the sin of the people. Verse 2, For then would they not have ceased to be offered. For the worshipers, once purified, would have had no more consciousness of sin. But in those sacrifices there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. Therefore, when he came into the world, he said, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you had no pleasure. Then I said, 'Behold, I have come. In the volume of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God.' Previously saying, 'Sacrifice and offering, burnt offerings and offerings for sin you did not desire, nor had pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law.' Then he said, 'Behold, I have come to do your will, O God.' He takes away the first that he may establish the second. By that will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all." Under the Old Testament law, they offered sacrifices continually. And the high priest entered the most holy place and offered a sacrifice for the people every year. And he had to keep going back every year and doing it again and again and again. But the only way that we could truly be adopted as God's children was for Christ to die, to shed his perfect blood once for all, so that we could be redeemed to God. It's the only way that it could happen. It couldn't happen through the blood of bulls and goats. It couldn't happen through the Old Testament law and the sacrifices that were offered. It required the sacrifice of Christ. That's the cost of our adoption. Adoption is expensive. And our spiritual adoption is likewise expensive. Adopted children are given a new name. A lot of folks may not be aware of this, but when, at least the way things work now, and, you know, these things kind of change over time sometimes, but in the case of both of our adoptions, our children were named by their birth mother. They were given a name that their birth mothers call them by. And in fact, Mary's birth mother, we had email contact with her for some time after Mary was born. And when she would write to us, she would always refer to Mary by the name she gave her. But when we adopted Mary and when we adopted Will, when we took them into our custody, we gave them a new name. We gave them the name we wanted them to have. And it's a different name than the name that their birth mother gave them. The same is true when we're adopted into God's family. We're given a new name. There are many terms, as we've already mentioned, many terms that are used to describe the followers of Christ in the New Testament. We talked about the different ways the relationships are described. Other terms are used to describe us, like disciples and saints and priests. But all of those terms have some history in the Old Testament. The children of Israel were disciples of God. They were referred to as the saints in the wilderness in one place. Those terms are not always used exclusively of Christians in the New Testament. The term priest is not exclusive, obviously, to the New Testament. Those terms were all used to describe God's followers in the Old Testament. But Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah 62, verses 1 and 2, "For Zion's sake I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until her righteousness goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a lamp that burns. The Gentiles shall see your righteousness and all kings your glory. You shall be called by a new name which the mouth of the Lord will name." Gary has talked about this passage in the past and has concluded, and I concur, that the term that's being talked about there is the term that we see first introduced in Acts chapter 11 and verse 26. When we read there at the end of the verse, the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. That term Christians was never used of those who followed God in the Old Testament. It is exclusive to those in the New Testament who meet the requirements that it takes that we're that we aren't going to talk about, but we could have talked about, the requirements that it takes to meet to be adopted into God's family. It's a name that's given to those that are Christ's. It's not given to anyone else. It's kind of interesting. I had this thought as I was putting together this final note on this, is, you know, many in the religious world claim this name for their own. There are lots of folks who aren't willing to submit to the requirements and actually be adopted into God's family who call themselves Christians. And to me, that kind of strikes me in our terms that we use in our society today. That's kind of a spiritual identity theft. Folks are stealing the identity of the disciples of Christ, of Christians, calling themselves by a name that doesn't really belong to them because they haven't been willing to do the things that are required to be adopted by God. The final thing I want to talk about for a few moments this evening is the idea that children who are adopted are brought into a new family. They have an entire new family that they become a part of. Some of you were present for one or both of our legal proceedings that we went through when we adopted our children. At some point, after you take custody of children and you've met all of the requirements that it takes after you've taken custody, that the state is now ready to grant you permanent custody of those children, then you have a legal proceeding that you have to go through in order to establish those rights permanently. And in both of our cases, we ended up doing that in a conference room over at the university over the telephone. They didn't make us drive all the way back to Florida and appear in court there because we were adopting our children under the laws of the state of Florida. And so some of you were able to be there and be present whenever those events took place. And if you were there, you may remember that one of the things that the judge stresses, and especially in Will's case, the judge in that case stressed this much more, I think, than the judge did in Mary's adoption. In that second adoption proceeding, the judge stressed to us that, and made us verbally assent to the idea that we understood that by adopting this child, we were taking responsibility for that child as if he were our biological child. That we would have the exact same responsibilities for raising that child and caring for that child and providing for that child as if he were our biological son. And adopted children, when the adoption is finalized, are issued a new birth certificate that indicates their adopted name and indicates the adoptive parents on the birth certificate. So we have birth certificates for Mary and for Will that name Susie and I as their parents. Because as far as the law is concerned, there's no difference in our family between those children and if we had biological children. And by the way, there's no difference in our hearts or minds on that either. I'm not trying to make an argument that the state makes a distinction that, or that the state doesn't make a distinction that we do. We certainly don't make that distinction either. I often forget that they are adopted children because they're just our children. That's just who they are. And there's really no difference between them being our children and other children being your children. They're children. They're our children. They're our family. They're part of our family. And one of the things that we've done with our two children to try to, I think in the long run, make them feel more a part of our family is we've given them traditional family names. So Marilyn is my wife's grandmother's name. Ruth is my grandmother's name. William is, but Susie and I both have grandparents with the name William. And my dad, and my name is David, and that's a name that I wanted to share with my son. And so we've given them names that are traditional family names in our families to make them, help them understand you're our family. There's no difference between you and any other child that we might have. And the same is true when we talk about spiritual adoption. When we look at some of the things that the New Testament says and some of the terms that are used to describe those who have been adopted by God, we see the same kind of idea carries through, that there is a new family that we become a part of. In Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 14, Paul writes there, "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of bondage again to fear, but you received the Spirit of adoption, by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. How much are we the children of God? We are joint heirs with Jesus, with Christ, who was the only begotten of the Father, as he's described in John 3 and verse 16. We are joint heirs with him. He is an heir. He is the begotten Son of God. We are the adopted children of God. We are heirs with him. We have the same inheritance that he has. We get to be with God for eternity. That's the inheritance that we have. We have that same inheritance. The word that's used for children in verse 16 in this passage, the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. The word that's used there, the original Greek word, is the same word that's used by Paul in Titus 1 and verse 6 when he's talking about those who would be elders and saying that they would have faithful children. And the word that's used there, the definition of that Greek word is a child as produced, indicating a biological child. And so the term would normally be used as used of a biological child. W.E. Vine says that, among other things, the word gives prominence to the fact of birth. And so it's a word that indicates a biological child. But Paul uses it in Romans 8 and verse 16 in the express context of talking about adoption. And I find that significant because he's using a word that would normally be used of a biological child and using that word to describe an adopted child. And I think the point he's making there is there's not a difference in God's eyes. That it's as if we were God's, and we are God's children. There's no distinction made. We're not some form of lesser child because we're adopted. We are his children. And as I said, that's the way the law looks at adoption even today, that those children are treated as if they are biological children. Again, in Galatians 4, verses 4 through 7, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into your heart, crying out, Abba, Father. Therefore you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir of God through Christ. It's some translations will translate that term child, and even one translation I saw translated it sons and daughters. And I don't know that that particularly does any harm to the passage. It may be, though, that the term that Paul is using in this passage is specific to sons because in the society in the time that Paul's writing, and even going all the way back through the Old Testament, who inherited? Sons inherited. Daughters didn't receive an inheritance. Sons inherited. So I don't know that he's using the term here to distinguish between sons and daughters. I think he's using the term here to describe we are children, as in sons who can inherit. We can all receive the inheritance. It's not a dependency upon what our gender is. Are we a son or a daughter? We're all sons in the sense that we can all inherit. We can all have an inheritance. And so we're part of that family. But that family is described in other terms as well. Mark chapter 10, verses 29 and 30, Mark records for us there, so Jesus answered and said, assuredly I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake in the Gospels who shall not receive a hundredfold now in this time, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecution, and in the time, age to come, eternal life. Jesus says, becoming my disciple may mean you have to give up the family you have here on earth, but you're going to receive a hundredfold another family. You're going to have other brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers and children. Those that are your family that you can be with and associate with and have that relationship with. We have a new family. A family that's greater than our physical family. It's wonderful when our physical family is also our spiritual family. But our spiritual family outranks, is more important, is better for us than just our physical family. It's great when they're both the same, but we need to be realizing the blessing that we have in our spiritual family. And I hope you'll bear with me for just a moment. A few weeks ago, Gary talked about the idea that we kind of have an aversion to naming people specifically for some of the good things that they do. And so I hope you'll bear with me as I do that for just a moment. I want to make sure that when I do this, that you don't think that I'm downplaying the help that we receive from people other than who I'm going to talk about specifically, because we receive some form of help from all kinds of people. As I look out across the audience, we've received help from just about everybody here in some form or another. And so we are certainly appreciative of that. All of you pray for us, and we definitely appreciate that and ask that you would continue to do that. But there are a couple of folks that I would just like to make mention of, because they have been particularly and especially helpful to us. And I'm afraid one is not here, and I didn't realize that until this morning that she wasn't going to be here. But Katie Pruitt has been a phenomenal help to us over the past, especially the past 2 years since Will was born. There have been a lot of times when I've not been able to take time off of work to go with Susie to Nashville, and it would be a great burden for her to try to deal with what she's dealing with in some of those appointments with Will and have Mary with her, and Mary gets bored and she doesn't like to be at the hospital that much. And so having somebody that's willing to take her very frequently and keep an eye on her or go along and be there to help out has been a tremendous blessing for us. And certainly others have been involved with Katie. She's not the only one. And Megan has been there with Katie, and Katie's brought some of the younger girls with her on multiple occasions to help out while she's there. Even recently, Katie took on watching Will by himself. Well, she had somebody else there to help her with Mary, but she was there to keep an eye on Will and take care of Will while Susie and I just had a chance to go out for a couple of hours. And that was a great blessing. And certainly there have been others that have been willing to do that. But I just wanted to mention Katie specifically, because she has been such a great help to us. And the others that I would like to mention just briefly, Stephanie Slavey and Tasha and Josie, they take Mary all the time, keep her entertained and have a good time with her. I think that Mary looks at Tasha and Josie like they're her sisters, because they're that close. And Tasha's even now volunteering to come with Susie to help out on trips to Nashville. And so we're just, you know, very, very thankful for folks like those that go above and beyond and do all kinds of special things to be helpful and help us out when we need that. And we need that a lot. So we're especially thankful for those. And there's lots of others, like I said, that I could mention. And you almost hate to mention anyone specifically, because others that you could mention don't get mentioned, and they may not, you know, they may feel overlooked, but I don't want anyone to feel that way. It's just that these folks have been especially helpful to us multiple times, and we're just so thankful for that. So, adoption is expensive. Adoption gives us a new name, and adoption adds us to a new family. But all of that is no accident. Ephesians chapter 1, beginning of verse 3, Paul writes there to the church at Ephesus, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in Christ, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before him in love, having predestined us to adoption as sons by the praise of the glory of his grace, by which he made us accepted in the beloved." God's been planning this method of adopting us since before the foundation of the world. I had thought about adding a point to the lesson about the idea that adoption takes planning, but it just seemed like this might fit a little better as we try to wrap things up this evening. But it does take planning, and God has been planning this since before the foundation of the world. It's no accident. It didn't just kind of happen. It wasn't an afterthought. God had this plan to adopt us before the world was ever created. And God wanted us in his family. And we see that then in what he was willing to pay to adopt us. He was willing to pay the blood of his son. Christ was willing to die. They were willing to pay that price that we could be adopted into the family of God. And so I just have two final questions for us to consider. If you are a Christian this evening, Have you been living up to the standard of being the child of the Most High God? Have you been living up to the standard of the payment that it took for God to adopt you? Have you lived up to the standard of the new name that God gave you when He adopted you into His family? And have you been living up to the standard of being in that family of God? If you're not a Christian, are you ready to be adopted into God's family? Are you ready to become His child and have access to the inheritance that He promises to all of His children? If you're ready to do that, then we would invite you to come tonight. And if you're a Christian who has not been living up to that standard, and you would like the prayers of the saints here, the prayers of your brothers and sisters, then we'd invite you to come forward as well. Would you come while we stand and while we sing?